If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism. Our first seven episodes covered the first 11 chapters of Genesis. Chapter 12 is significant because it is something of a dividing line within the story the scriptures tell. Chapters 1 through 11 are a primeval history, or history before recorded history began, if you will. But in chapter 12, the story begins to record more specific people, in recorded sequence, in places that are still identifiable today. If Genesis 1 through 11 is sort of an opaque prehistory, then Genesis 12 is the beginning of what we might call ancient history. So, let's put this into some perspective. The Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt was probably, and I'm saying probably because archaeologists argue about this, but probably built sometime around 2500 BC. Now, the patriarch Abram, who Genesis 12 introduces, probably, and I'm saying probably because archaeologists argue about this, probably lived sometime around 2000 BC, ballpark. And Genesis 12 records Abram going to Egypt. Therefore, Abram would have seen the Great Pyramid of Egypt when it had already been standing for 500 years. So, while we can't locate a specific time or place for Noah's Ark or the Tower of Babel, beginning in Genesis 12, the Bible starts recording a story within an identifiable period of ancient history. But it's doing it through a very specific lens. The Old Testament doesn't mention the Great Pyramid, although it's without a doubt that the pyramid was standing when the book of Genesis was written, and the writers of Genesis must have been aware of it. But the pyramid is not relevant to the story that the Genesis is telling. It's not here to record pyramids. The story is narrowing its focus. It's zooming in on God's plan for redemption through a specific nation, Israel, descended from a specific clan, founded on a specific man, the patriarch Abram. Other nations, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans, are all mentioned in the Bible when they intersect the story of Israel. But the Bible isn't written to document or describe them. So, in chapter 12, the backstory of chapters 1 through 11 is over, and the tale of Israel's origin begins. Genesis 12, verse 1. The Lord had said to Abram, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land that I will show you." So who was Abram? At the end of chapter 11, we read that he was the son of a man named Terah, who was a direct descendant of Noah's son, Shem. This is the family line through which God has chosen to work. And at the end of chapter 11, we read that Terah had taken his family from a place called Ur. Now, archaeologists have never positively identified Ur, but the general consensus is that it was probably a city, long lost or rebuilt over 100 times, in what is now eastern Iraq. Genesis 11 tells us that Terah migrated with his family, including his son Abram and Abram's wife Sarah, to a city called Haran, which is generally agreed to be in the northern Mesopotamian plain, now in southeastern Turkey. It was a center of worship for the moon god, Shin. So, God told Abram to leave his family, the clan of Terah, now living in Haran, and go to a new land that God would show him. God's instructions are a bit light on the what and the where, but they're heavy on the why. He tells Abram, "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." God has picked this one man, descended from Adam's son Seth through Noah, through Shem, to become the father of a great nation through which all peoples on earth, all of the nations, will be blessed. Why Abram? In the New Testament book of Hebrews, we're told that Abram obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going, because he had faith in God's voice. Abram wasn't perfect, but he did have a righteous faith, and when God asked him to do something, he did it. Change has to begin somewhere. Every journey has to have a first step. And God chose to use that faithful obedience of Abram as a foundation or a conduit for blessing the world. Just as we might light one little tiny piece of paper in our fireplace, which then spreads to all the logs, bringing light and warmth through our home. So Abram's response to God's call in the first verses of Genesis 12 is like the kindling that will ignite the redemption and restoration of the world. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and their clan, families, servants, sheep, and other animals, tents and possessions and all of that, and set out as nomads to wherever God led them, which ended up being the land of Canaan. The biblical land of Canaan is a large area that roughly corresponds to, on our modern map, modern-day Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, Jordan, and the southern portions of Syria and Lebanon. Now, when Abram got to Canaan, the Lord appeared to him and said, "This is the place. To your offspring, I will give this land." The problem, of course, was that Canaan was full of Canaanites, and that will be the underlying plot complication for the rest of the Old Testament. Throughout their entire history, God's people, the nation of Israel, will struggle with the Canaanites, as well as with others from outside Canaan who want this land, Assyrians, Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, Romans. But Israel will not just struggle to control the land, it will be a constant battle to keep the culture of Canaan from controlling them. For the rest of the Old Testament, Israel will follow up a cycle of being faithful to their God, but then falling again and again and again into the worship of the Canaanite gods. In their hearts and lives, the struggle for God's plan will play out. Now, much of Canaan was, still is, rolling rocky terrain with dry grasses, with sources of water few and far between. It was ideal for grazing animals, mostly sheep, but not really for large-scale farming. And this suited Abram, his nephew Lot, and their clans. After a number of years, they had vast flocks of animals. Along with their servants, herdsmen, retainers, and all their families, they traveled throughout Canaan, seasonal nomads in tents, searching for grass and water. Some of these people and flocks belonged to or were loyal to Abram, and some to his nephew Lot. But eventually, their herdsmen began to skirmish over grazing lands and water rights. So, Abram said to his nephew, "Look, this land is vast, but we keep bumping into each other. Let's spread out. You pick first. If you go to the north, I'll go to the south. If you go to the east, I'll go to the west." And then Lot makes an unexpected decision. He looks down from the hills of Canaan to the plains beyond the Jordan River, and there were cities out there, and Lot finds them attractive. Throughout the book of Genesis, cities represent mankind striving to live independent from God. Cain builds a city, and his descendants build more cities. Mankind tries to unite in the city of Babel. God calls Abram out of the city of Haran. When the Hebrews become slaves in Egypt, Pharaoh has them building treasure cities. During the age of the patriarchs, the godly line of Seth and Shem lived in the wilderness as shepherds, depending on God. But Lot is tired of wandering around the hills, tired of living in tents, tired of looking for grazable fields. He becomes enchanted by the cities of the plain. It looks like a better life, one in which a man can take control of his own destiny. And so, he tells Abram that he will leave the nomadic shepherd life and move to the big city. So the two men part company. Abram continues to wander about following God, while Lot moves outside the walls of a city named Sodom, where we are told that the people are wicked and sinning greatly against the Lord. At first, he just pitches his tent outside Sodom's walls, close, but not yet all in. After Lot left, the Lord said to Abram, "All the land that you see I will give to you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you." Now, this is an important part of the promises that God will play out over the rest of the story that the scriptures tell. This is the promise of the land to the descendants of Abram, and we'll see it come up over and over and over again. And God reiterates his promise to make him the father of a great nation, but now he's told that his descendants will be as numerous as the grains of sand spread across the earth. The spark that God kindles in Abram will spread beyond imagination. Not long after that, Lot's choice of Sodom has already gotten him into trouble. The cities of the plain are wrapped up in endless wars with each other, men violently striving for power over each other instead of following and trusting God. And Lot, who we discover has moved into the city by now, getting more wrapped up in its wicked ways, is taken as a prisoner of war when Sodom and Gomorrah are raided by their enemies. So, Abram gathers the 318 trained warriors in his clan and goes in hot pursuit. They rout the enemy and they free Lot. And then, three curious things happen. First, a mysterious priest named Melchizedek shows up to offer sacrifice to God for the victory of Abram over the army of wicked cities on the plain. We're told that he is the king of a place called Salem. Now, remember that name, Salem. It's going to pop up again in our next episode and more after that throughout the rest of the story the scriptures tell, right up to the very last chapter of the Bible. If you're taking notes, write it down, S-A-L-E-M. And when Melchizedek, king of Salem and priest of the one true God, offers a sacrifice and blesses Abram, Abram tithes to him, gives him a tenth of everything. The New Testament book of Hebrews brings up this incident and tells us that Melchizedek foreshadows Christ. As we've seen, everything in the Old Testament points toward Christ and the redemption and restoration that he brings. The second curious thing is that when the king of Sodom offers Abram the plunder from the battle, Abram absolutely refuses it. He won't take anything from this wicked king, lest it be said that he is indebted to this wicked city, or that this wicked city made Abram prosperous. The third curious, troubling, and sad thing that happens is that Lot moves back to Sodom. He hasn't learned his lesson. Genesis chapter 15 opens with a conversation between God and Abram. "After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. 'Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward.' But Abram said, 'Sovereign Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless, and the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus?' And Abram said, 'You have given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir.'" You see, at this point, Abram is wealthy, with hundreds or thousands of people in his camp. But he and Sarai have no children of their own. He has no heir. Now, this would be troubling for anyone, but it's especially problematic for Abram, because God has promised twice now to make him the father of a great, uncountable nation. But he can't have millions or billions of descendants until he first has one. And that hasn't happened yet. And he and Sarai are getting very, very old. Then the word of the Lord came to him. "This man will not be your heir, but a son who is your own flesh and blood will be your heir." He took him outside and said, "Look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them." And then he said to Abram, so shall your offspring be. St. Paul, in his letter to the Romans, recalls Abram's response as a critical moment in the story of salvation, and the basis of God's covenant, which will lead to the salvation and restoration of the world. Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. Abram makes the choice of faith. Now, that might strike our modern ears as odd, because we tend to think of faith as something that you either have or don't have, like freckles or the measles. But biblical faith is a choice. We choose to believe God's promises, like a bride and groom choose to believe each other's wedding promises. God tells Abram that he will have a son, and that son will have sons, and eventually his descendants will be as numerous as the stars in the sky or the grains of sand across the land. And that choice to believe God's promises, what we might call deliberate faith, is considered by God as righteousness. In his letter to the Romans, St. Paul says that Abram didn't earn God's promise, but he believed it, and that faith was credited to his account. And St. Paul says that when we believe God's promise in Christ, our faith is credited to our account. It is that faith, not our works, that opens the door to salvation. But Abram's wife Sarah didn't believe God. She was growing increasingly desperate to have a child, to raise an heir for Abram. So she comes up with a terrible plan. She convinces Abram to sleep with her indentured servant, a young Egyptian woman named Hagar, in a sort of surrogate pregnancy scheme. Hagar will give birth, and then Sarah will take the child and raise it as Abram's heir. Of course, no good comes from the scheme, for two reasons. First, it's dishonest and complicated, and people are going to get hurt. More importantly, it's born out of distrust of God, which has devolved into despair. It's exactly the opposite of faith. It's a choice to disbelieve God and to take matters into her own hands. And it does turn out badly. Hagar becomes pregnant by Sarai's design and begins to act all haughty towards Sarai. After all, she's sleeping with her husband because Sarai is infertile. And Sarai does not like her attitude one little bit. So, Sarai chases Hagar out into the wilderness. But God has mercy on her. And since she's carrying Abram's child, God promises that the boy, his name will be Ishmael, will also become the father of a nation, but not the nation through which salvation will come. Interestingly, Ishmael is considered by both the Old Testament and the Islamic Quran as the father of the Arab nation. But that's a story for another time. As if to underscore the importance of the promise to Abram's descendants, God next institutes the covenant of circumcision. God mandates that all males descended from Abram must be circumcised on the eighth day after birth. Now, modern people find this bizarre and brutal, and cannot fathom how it could possibly be relevant to faith in God. But that's because we think of faith as a spiritual feeling, not a choice to believe in the practical promises of God to work through history to redeem and restore a fallen universe. Now, we could say a lot about circumcision, but let me be rather direct and maybe even a little bit indelicate. God marks the male reproductive organs of his people as a visible sign, a constant reminder, that the salvation of the world would come through the seed of Abram. Through that seed, passing through those circumcised organs, the descendants of Abram would become as numerous as the stars of the sky. And ultimately, through them would come the Messiah, the Christ, that would redeem the universe. When he makes the covenant of circumcision, to underscore his point, God renames Abram and Sarai. Abram fell face down, and God said to him, "As for me, this is my covenant with you. You will be the father of many nations. No longer will you be called Abram. Your name will be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations." So, Abram is renamed Abraham or Abram. In Hebrew, Abram means exalted father, but Abraham means father of multitudes. His very name will now be a further sign of God's covenant promises. God continues, I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you, for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. As for Sarai, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. Now in Hebrew, Sarai means something like princess, and her new name, Sarah, means something like queen. So she's getting a promotion. God continues, I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her. Now Abraham's reaction shows that even he, a man of great faith, struggles to believe this promise. He laughs and says, will a 100-year-old man have a child with a 90-year-old wife? And later, when Sarah or Sarah hears God say that she will soon have a son, she also laughs and says, am I to finally have my heart's desire when I'm a shriveled old woman? And God says to them, yes, yes, you will. And you will name the boy Isaac, which means in Hebrew, laughter, so that every time you say his name, you will be reminded that God keeps promises that seem laughable to men. This whole episode is more than a chapter in the Old Testament narrative. It's an important lesson for us. Because, as St. Paul says in his letter to the Corinthians, God's promises seem foolish, laughable, to the sophisticated secular mind. For example, believing that we will be bodily resurrected from the dead because Jesus was first seemed like a bad joke to the Greek philosophers of Paul's day, or to the media-technocratic elite of our day. Even today, believing the gospel subjects us to ridicule, or even worse. But just as it was in Abraham's day, faith is still a choice to trust God, even when his promises seem laughable. And so, God uses visible signs like circumcision, Isaac's name, or the bread and wine of the Eucharist to remind us and invite us to continue to choose to trust him.